ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Wednesday, the 7th of January. I'm Annie Guest, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Today, heatwave warnings across large swathes of the country as temperatures soar in Victoria and South Australia. And all aboard the Elvis Express, more than 20,000 fans descend on the town of Parkes to celebrate the king of rock and roll.
You're looking for trouble.
So this is our maiden voyage, my wife and I.
We've been over to Graceland and visited, haven't we? And we thought we'll do the whole experience here in Parkes.
This guy likes Elvis, but I don't walk around going, thank you very much every day, don't get me wrong.
But first, Donald Trump's ambitions over Greenland have been reaffirmed, with the White House today not ruling out using the military to acquire the semi-autonomous territory of Denmark. The increasing rhetoric about Greenland follows the capture of the Venezuelan leader, Nicolas Maduro, and the planned takeover of the country's oil production. Greenland and Denmark have both called for a speedy meeting with the United States, while the leaders of major European powers have released a statement supporting Danish sovereignty. Meanwhile, at a key meeting in Paris over Ukraine, the UK and France have pledged to deploy troops to Ukraine if a peace deal is made with Russia. Rachel Hayter reports.
US President Donald Trump's expansionist ambitions are becoming increasingly clear.
We need Greenland from a national security situation.
Today, the White House released a statement saying President Trump has been discussing a range of options to acquire Greenland, including the use of military force.
It's so strategic. Right now, Greenland is covered with Russian and Chinese ships all over the place.
Greenland is a semi-autonomous territory in the Kingdom of Denmark and has repeatedly said it does not want to be part of the United States. 57,000 people call the island home, which contains natural resources, including rare earths, uranium and iron. White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller has told CNN a US takeover of Greenland is in NATO's interests.
For the United States to secure the Arctic region, to protect and defend NATO and NATO interests, obviously Greenland should be part of the United States.
The reality would actually be the biggest crisis in NATO's history, according to former NATO official and professor of strategy and security at the University of Exeter, Jamie Shea.
It would be an instance of one NATO ally attacking the territory of another NATO ally, when the whole purpose of NATO, of course, is solidarity of allies against external threats.
The Prime Minister of Denmark, Mette Frederiksen, warns a US takeover of Greenland would bring about the end of NATO. Jamie Shea again.
It would certainly hollow out NATO and make it into a far less cohesive and effective alliance.
Stephen Lammy is an expert on Arctic politics and Professor Emeritus of International Relations and Spatial Sciences at the University of Southern California. He argues the Trump administration has a disdain for collective security.
He has been very critical of NATO, not just in terms of budget issues, et cetera. We can see this in his policy toward Ukraine. So he does not really see these countries as relevant to his security interests, which are unilateralism.
Professor Emeritus Lammy has challenged President Trump's assertion that Russian and Chinese presence in Greenland poses a security threat to the United States. He believes this is about economics.
This is about access to the rare earth elements, rare earth minerals that Greenland has, and keeping them away for China.
Meanwhile, in Europe, after a landmark meeting in Paris, the UK and France have agreed to deploy troops to Ukraine if a peace deal is made with Russia. Ukraine's ambassador to Australia, Vasyl Moroshnichenko, has indicated there's no requirement yet for ADF involvement.
When the right time comes, there will be a request made for any of the Australian troops. For now, the key priority is, of course, for those based in Europe. Australia can certainly contribute to the coalition and the willing by supplying air defence missiles or providing more equipment.
Ambassador Moroshnichenko says Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky briefed the Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese on peace negotiations with Russia in a phone call earlier this week.
Rachel Hayter. For more on the potential implications of Donald Trump's Greenland ambitions, I spoke to one of Australia's leading experts in international law, Professor Don Rothwell from the Australian National University. Professor Don Rothwell, Donald Trump has long eyed off Greenland, but in the context of the Venezuelan intervention, how significant are today's comments from the White House that acquiring Greenland is an active topic of discussion in the Oval Office and not ruling out military involvement?
The first Trump presidency vaguely floated the idea of the United States acquiring Greenland. And then following Donald Trump's re-election, Donald Trump Jr. made a rather extraordinary day visit to Greenland. Perhaps most importantly, the other major change, I think, is the November 2025 US National Security Strategy, which directly talks about the Western Hemisphere. And Greenland is at the periphery of the Western Hemisphere. I think the other important point to note is that following the remarkable military success of the Venezuelan operation, the United States has been able to demonstrate its clear military superiority. That superiority would be even greater in the context of Greenland.
So how seriously do you think we should take this suggestion of annexing an ally?
Look, I think I would certainly see it more as another example of rhetoric coming out of the Trump White House. And we've seen a lot of that in the last 48 hours with respect to a number of territories, Cuba, Colombia also being mentioned. Ultimately, my judgment would be that any military takeover of Greenland, and I emphasise military takeover akin to the intervention we saw in Venezuela, would absolutely result in a fracturing of NATO and absolutely result in a fracturing of the United States' relationship with many of its core Western allies around the world.
So given those huge ramifications, is it possible that Donald Trump and the White House may be referencing the military in the form of perhaps potential agreements to have bases and to station forces there in Greenland in a cooperative arrangement?
Yes, I very much see it in that sense, in that the Trump rhetoric, which is being ratcheted up, obviously in light of the events in Venezuela, is really showing to, in the first case, the Danes, that the United States is really showing serious intent and that, as Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, has indicated, the United States is not taking any options off the table. But setting aside the military option, there are clearly a range of political, diplomatic and economic options that the United States can pursue in terms of acquiring an enhanced interest in Greenland.
Greenland has a large indigenous presence and is moving towards self-determination from Denmark. What's the relevance of that in this scenario?
Well, the relevance is that the United States can seek to negotiate on these issues with Denmark, but Denmark would very rightly say, well, look, we've put in process a role here for the Greenlanders to ultimately enjoy self-determination. And in my view, in the normal course of events, we could be looking at an independent Greenland in the next 10 to 15 years. And Denmark would very much say, well, look, we can't make decisions on our own with respect to Greenland. We need to actively consult with the Greenlanders. And if the Greenlanders are not agreeable to the United States taking this enhanced role, whatever form it might take, we have to respect their wishes. Ultimately, to a degree, the Greenlandic population really has a veto over many of these aspirations that the Trump White House might be seeking to pursue.
Professor Don Rothwell, thanks for joining The World Today.
Pleased to speak with you.
And that's Professor Don Rothwell, an expert in international law at the Australian National University. US President Donald Trump has announced he's come to a deal with Venezuela's interim government for up to 50 million barrels of oil. Venezuela is currently being governed by Nicolas Maduro's former deputy, but the country's pro-Trump opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, has also just emerged from a self-imposed exile to announce she plans to return to her country. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
Even before the United States captured Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, the politics there was complicated. Venezuela's opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, was forced into hiding, fearing her life was at risk under Maduro's regime. Now he's gone, and she's planning her return.
I mean, January 3rd will go down in history as the day justice defeated a tyranny.
Speaking to Fox News, Ms. Machado praised the US President Donald Trump and the US operation to remove Maduro and vowed to return to Venezuela.
It's a huge step towards a democratic transition.
Maria Corina Machado has been a political opponent and outspoken critic of Maduro's party, the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, for decades. She was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2025 for her struggle to achieve a just and peaceful transition from dictatorship to democracy. And she's long supported President Trump's actions in Venezuela, even dedicating her Nobel Prize to him. But the US president has backed Delcy Rodriguez, Maduro's deputy, who's been sworn in as Venezuela's interim president.
And she's essentially willing to do what we think is necessary to make Venezuela great again. Very simple.
However, in an address on Venezuelan TV on Tuesday, Delcy Rodriguez described the removal of President Maduro by the U.S. as a violation of international law.
El gobierno de Venezuela.
The Venezuelan government rules our country, no one else. There is no external agent governing Venezuela. It is Venezuela.
Chris Arsenault is the chair of the journalism program at Canada's Western University and a former journalist who spent many years reporting in Venezuela.
Politically speaking, she's walking a very clear tightrope. If she says, thanks for making me President Donald Trump, I'm very happy to do your bidding, that doesn't play well for an avowedly anti-imperialist, ostensibly socialist party who's running the show.
Chris Arsenault says for the US, Delcy Rodriguez represents the most straightforward option for its mission in Venezuela.
They aren't framing this as any sort of attempt to bring democracy back to Venezuela or any kind of attempt to improve human rights. It's being framed very clearly and very directly by the Trump administration as we want to keep in charge whoever's going to help us get the oil out of the ground.
Mark Jones is a professor of political science at Rice University and an expert in Latin American politics. He says installing Maria Corina Machado into power instead of Rodriguez would likely require a protracted US presence in Venezuela, which isn't politically viable.
You have almost universal opposition among Democrats to Trump's gambit in Venezuela. And the MAGA movement has a strong isolationist wing, and it's not at all happy with even the limited U.S. involvement in Venezuela, let alone anything that would involve the loss of the U.S. lives and billions of U.S. taxpayer dollars for what they deride as nation building, pointing to failures in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. So Trump knows full well that there's no way that he can send U.S. troops inside to maintain order in Venezuela, which means he needs to work with, at least for the present time, people like Delcy Rodriguez, Diosdado Cabello, and Vladimir Padrino López, sort of the triumvirate that has the most influence and power today.
That's Rice University Professor of Political Science Mark Jones. Bridget Fitzgerald reporting. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. More than half of the country is expected to swelter in what authorities are expecting to be the worst heat wave since the devastating Black Summer bushfires. The Bureau of Meteorology is warning people in Australia's southeast to prepare for multiple consecutive days of hot conditions this week and extreme fire conditions with temperatures set to top 45 degrees. Kathleen O'Connor reports.
In Melbourne's South Bank near the Yarra River, locals and visitors were out and about early looking for ways to keep cool.
We've had 40 degrees in Christchurch before, once, but not 42. The kids don't know what 42 degrees is.
Not in their lifetimes.
When it gets too hot and everyone gets grumpy at me, we'll go inside somewhere where there's some air conditioning.
I'm excited for the air conditioning.
I'm excited about going back to Christchurch.
for the nice cool weather.
Authorities say temperatures are expected to soar across the state today, with a predicted top of 42 degrees in Melbourne.
We'll be indoors in the aircon,
just sitting back, having a few cocktails, put the aircon on and close all the blinds, make it all dark inside and spend the day on the couch just cool and chilling.
Omar Malik manages a boat touring company along the Yarra River. He's rinsing the boats, ready for the busy day, but says he's closing early to protect his customers and staff from the heat.
We do shut from 12 till 6 at the peak heat, just because it's a bit unsafe to be out on the water. The boats have very little cover, but I mean, they're beautiful on a warm day. 42 degrees is getting a bit up there for anyone to be comfortable out there.
The last time Melbourne saw temperatures like this was 6 years ago during the Black Summer bushfires. It's expected to be even hotter in South Australia with a top of 45 degrees. Helen Reid is from the Bureau of Meteorology.
Widespread severe to extreme intensity heatwave conditions are forecast across much of South Australia, New South Wales, Victoria and northeast Tasmania.
Helen Reid says earlier in the week, heat has been building across Western Australia and has now moved east, impacting much of southern and southeast Australia.
Melbourne City is set to hit 42 degrees today, with the same temperature forecast in Geelong. Canberra is forecast to reach 35 degrees today, with even hotter temperatures forecast from tomorrow, 3 days in a row of 38 degrees from Thursday to Saturday. For Hobart, it won't be as sweltering as the mainland, but we're still expecting a top temperature today of 28 degrees, around 6 degrees above the average for this time of year.
Experts say today's hot weather is just the beginning of a major heat wave across southeast Australia.
This heat wave is forecast to persist until Friday through South Australia, Victoria, northern Tasmania and inland New South Wales.
Authorities are preparing for the worst, with hot conditions, dry thunderstorms and gusty winds all posing an extreme fire danger risk. Jason Heffernan is Chief Officer of the Victorian Country Fire Authority.
Friday is the one that has authorities very much concerned, where we're likely to see widespread, very high extreme fire dangers, but it's going to be those very strong to potentially destructive northerly winds that will come across the state later in the afternoon on the Friday that has us all concerned.
Nicola Cray is from the Australian Red Cross. She says everyone must monitor their health across the coming days.
On extreme heat days, everybody's vulnerable. The body doesn't regulate. Temperatures are not going down in the evenings, and so everybody needs to be aware that heat can kill.
Nicola Cray from the Red Cross, ending that report by Kathleen O'Connor. The exploitation of Australian garment workers has long been an issue, but experts are warning too many are still being ripped off. There has been improvement, with some Australian companies joining a voluntary accreditation program to make sure they're doing the right thing. But human rights advocates argue tougher reforms are needed, as Stephanie Smale reports.
When she arrived in Australia 10 years ago, Rose, who doesn't want to use her real name, worked in a factory and then started to sew at home. She says she was working long hours as a so-called outworker with not much pay.
So roughly 10 hours per day, working 7 days and getting paid by the hours from 10 to 12 and maximum 15.
Rose is speaking with translation by Nguyet Nguyen, an outreach officer for the Timber, Furnishing and Textiles Union. Rose says she contacted the union for help in getting the money she was owed.
It is a big amount, like thousands of dollars that the company owed, and also annual leave and like holiday pay and superannuation and all the money.
Nguyet Nguyen says it's hard to gauge the full extent of the problem because people are working at home, but she says Rose isn't alone.
So only a small amount of outworkers, they're getting paid correctly. A lot of them, because they don't understand the law.
Ethical Clothing Australia's national manager, Rachel Riley, says work is underway to fix the problem, but it's tough going.
Because of the cascading nature of supply chains in this industry, where a business can give out
work to another business, who gives out work to another business, who might give out work to someone that's acting as an intermediary. It's really hard to follow that chain.
The organisation runs a voluntary accreditation program that involves a full supply chain audit. Rachel Riley again.
So we often get businesses that sign up and they may not be aware that they are actually not abiding by their existing obligations under Australian workplace laws. So we support them to get that embedded into their operation.
The University of New South Wales Australian Human Rights Institute has looked at the Ethical Clothing Australia program and found it is making a difference. But Director Professor Justine Nolan says there's more work to do.
There's still too many, I think, companies doing a sort of a go it alone, like, trust us, we'll figure this out, we've got your back. And really what you need is external verification.
Professor Nolan says a review of the Modern Slavery Act was tabled in 2023, but there's been little significant reform since.
We know the Act has been useful in raising awareness of issues in supply chains, but it has not had an impact in really reforming those. So what that tells us is we've got a law, but it's not effective. So how do we change this law and make it more effective? And one of those is to bring an obligation in around due diligence, and others include having an enforcement approach in the law.
The federal government says the Attorney General's department is working to identify how the Modern Slavery Act could be amended to enhance its due diligence requirements.
Stephanie Smale. With their blue suede shoes and bedazzled jackets, hundreds of Elvis fans converged on Sydney Central Station this morning, ready to head to the iconic Parkes Elvis Festival. The festival's been running since 1993, with this year's theme, Love Me Tender. Julia Bergen joined festival goers as they boarded the Elvis Express.
You're looking for trouble. You have came to the right place.
Flares, jumpsuits, pompadours, sideburns and shades. Elvis Presley fans spared no expense this morning.
So we went all out to make sure that we looked like Elvis.
Yes.
Talk me through the outfit.
Well, online basically, everything. We got online the wig, Amazon.
This is now natural hair.
It's perfectly coiffed.
Oh, yeah, well, we spent a lot of time doing the hair this morning.
The thing is, my costume didn't turn up, so I just decided to get really dressed up.
Throngs of diehards danced and grooved inside Sydney's Central Station before choosing a carriage and a seat on the Elvis Express. Viva Las Vegas Line, Burning Love Bullet, Priscilla's Place, all off to the small New South Wales town of Parkes, about 5 hours west of Sydney, in the name of the King of Rock and Roll.
The wife's not a terrible Elvis fan. I've got to have an Elvis statue in my man cave with the jukebox and the Harley, of course. And I've been to Memphis myself, like 20 years ago or more, 30 years ago. And we rock and roll dance and stuff. And I said, I want to do the Parkes Festival. And she said, oh, OK. When she walked in, she got excited. This guy likes Elvis. But I don't walk around going, thank you very much, every day. Don't get me wrong.
So this is our maiden voyage from my wife and I.
We've been over to Graceland and visited, haven't we? And we thought we'll do the whole experience here in Parkes.
Since 1983, Parkes has been home to this festival. It started as a small birthday party for Elvis with 195 people and has since grown to 27,000, with hundreds of millions more tuning in around the world.
Up to around 25,000 will be there by the weekend, but the town is absolutely heaving.
That's Parkes Mayor Neil Westcott, who's dressed in a blue rhinestone suit.
The previous mayor did put the chains of responsibility over my head and whisper in my ear and say, Neil, get a jumpsuit and learn a song. So that's how it worked.
At Parkes, Festival Director Brendan Shipley says the town is buzzing.
His music creates this feeling of joy and it makes you feel the emotions that you would usually, I think, keep better down sometimes. So it allows you to express yourself. And when you have a town full of 25 to 28,000 people all doing the same thing, it's hard not to get addicted to it.
One of those ready to harness the spirit of the king is Maria Phillips, better known as Platinum Elvis. She's competing in the Ultimate Elvis Tribute Artist Contest.
Love me tender, love me sweet, never let me go.
You have personally, if I can be an advocate for being a female Elvis tribute artist and bring more people in, that's a great result. We're not limited to just the men in the world.
Tender, love me true, all my dreams fulfilled.
Tribute artist Maria Phillips with her rendition of Love Me Tender, ending that report by Julia Bergen. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Annie Guest.